we're talking about the repeal of net neutrality 1 year in. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Net neutrality had prevented internet providers from blocking specific web pages or from giving preferential treatment to particular sites. But the head of the Federal Communications Commission, Ajit Pai, said the repeal of net neutrality would bring back the regulation-free policy that helped the internet thrive. It would lead to a free and open internet. And some warned of dire consequences that we'd see an internet Armageddon unfolding. So where are we at today? Are you in favor of or against net neutrality? Do you think internet service providers like Comcast and AT&T should be regulated by the government? We're at 800-642-1234. Gigi Sohn is a distinguished fellow at Georgetown Law Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy. She serves on the Electronic Frontier Foundation Board of Directors, and she was at the Federal Communications Commission from 2013 to 2016 as a counselor to the chairman. Gigi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, before we get into the nuts and bolts of net neutrality, can you step back for us and explain what it is and what it does?
Sure. You actually did quite a good job. So net neutrality is the principle that you and I should control our internet experience. We should decide where we want to go on the internet, what we want to do, and who the winners and losers are on the internet. Net neutrality prevents an ISP from taking over an internet service provider like Comcast, like Verizon, like AT&T. It prevents your internet service provider from doing that for you. Well, how would they do that? Well, they could block certain traffic that they don't like. They could throttle the speeds of certain traffic. So they could promise you a certain speed, but throttle back that speed so a website comes up slower than it's supposed to. Or, and this is the thing that frankly people are most worried about, they could charge certain websites or certain services like Netflix more money to get to the customer faster. And that really is the antithesis of how the internet was designed. The internet was designed to put control in your hands and my hands. So the people at the ends of the network, as opposed to an internet service provider in the middle of the network.
Well, remind us how we got here, because last year net neutrality was repealed by the FCC. It was actually December of 2017. That went into effect June of last year. Tell us more about the FCC's decision to end net neutrality. What went into that?
Well, I think I need to tell you first about how we even got to 2017, how we got to the repeal. So I'm going to take you back to 2002.
Okay.
And we were in a world, it was mostly dial-up internet. It wasn't not this fast broadband internet that we
have
today.
Wasn't fancy. Mm-hmm.
No, it
You've
wasn't
got mail.
It wasn't fancy, but the average American had a choice of 13 dial-up internet service providers. And that was because the law regulated those companies like telephone companies. Okay, so telephone companies are more heavily regulated under the Communications Act. And under telephone rules, the dominant telephone company in an area had to make their facilities available to competitors. So we had 13. Can you imagine that? Most
No.
Americans don't have a choice of more than two. And many have a choice, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, air quotes, have a choice of one. Well, the FCC decided to deregulate the internet, particularly broadband internet, which is kind of coming on board around 2002, and said, you know what, this isn't like a telephone service. This is unregulated. Okay, we're not going to regulate it anymore. And life went on until 2015. There were a series of court cases, and it's funny, the opponents of net neutrality always tend to forget these court cases, where the FCC tried several times to put net neutrality into law, to prohibit blocking, to prohibit throttling, to prohibit what we call paid prioritization or fast lanes by internet service providers. And each time the court said your rationale isn't adequate enough. So in 2015, when I was at the FCC, we finally said, look, the FCC essentially was wrong until the facts had changed since 2002, and that we are going to regulate broadband internet access more, not completely, but more like a telephone service. And guess what? The court said, bingo, you figured it out. You gave the right rationale. We're upholding your rules. But that wasn't good enough for the Trump FCC. And in 2017, they repealed the rules. And this is, in my opinion, even more important, they abdicated the FCC's responsibility to engage in any kind of oversight over the broadband market. And even in the most deregulatory Republican FCCs from 2002 to 2017, no FCC chair said, you know what, we don't think we should have any business protecting consumers and competition when it comes to the most important communications network of our lifetime. But this chairman, Ajit Pai, has said this. They said, we don't need to protect consumers and competition when it comes to broadband. We'll turn that over to the Federal Trade Commission, which has much more limited tools. Those are my words, not his words, which I talk about later. I could talk about that later.
I'm going to pause right there. We're talking about the rollback of net neutrality 1 year in. We're checking in on internet access in our country. Gigi Sohn is a distinguished fellow at the Georgetown Law Institute for Technology, Law and Policy. So do you think internet service providers should be regulated by the government? Should they be allowed to charge websites like Netflix extra for using a lot of bandwidth? Or should that be outlawed to prevent internet providers from favoring certain sites and content? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Gigi, before net neutrality was then established in 2015, have we seen proof? Have we seen internet providers doing this slowing down of the internet or this throttling, as you talk about more in this past year?
Well, there is some evidence. There was research done by a researcher at Northeastern University that, in fact, some internet service providers were slowing down Netflix. We're slowing down other video applications, but I wouldn't focus on that. I think that's not a good use of our time to discuss that. What I think is more important are the consequences of the FCC abdicating its responsibility to oversee the broadband market. Because frankly, in a lot of ways, I mean, that's actually more dangerous to life and property. So with your permission, I'd love to talk about three instances, and I can talk about them very briefly, where this lack of oversight has affected the American people deeply. And the first happened last year during the Mendocino Camp Fire, which at the time was the biggest fire in California history. Well, at that time, and for about 6 months beforehand, Verizon was throttling the broadband service of the Santa Clara County Fire Department, which was in charge of coordinating emergency response through its broadband system to the fire. And for 7 months, the fire department engaged in this, you know, battle with Verizon. Please, we're in the middle of this emergency. We need to have our full broadband service. And Verizon said, kept saying, well, if you pay us 2.5 times more, we will restore your full broadband service. And lo and behold, that's what the fire department did because it had to, because it was in the middle of this fire. Well, the problem with that is that the fire department had nowhere to go.
And we need to pause right there with that story. Gigi Sohn is our guide. She's a distinguished fellow at the Georgetown Law Institute for Technology, Law and Policy. We're talking about the repeal of net neutrality 1 year later. What does it mean? You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. We'll be back on this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the rolling back of net neutrality 1 year after the FCC's new rules went into effect. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The repeal of Obama-era net neutrality rules faced widespread criticism. The big fear was that consumers could be taken advantage of by internet bandwidth carriers based on the type of websites and web services they access. But the FCC says internet speeds actually have increased by 40% in the U.S. last year, and U.S. homes wired for broadband, that hit a record high. So what is internet access like in your home or in your community? Do you have problems getting online? What would help the most? Where do you stand on net neutrality? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Gigi Sohn stays with us. She is a distinguished fellow at the Georgetown Law Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy. Gigi, we're going to pick up that story as you were talking about the California wildfires and this fire department that went over its data plan. It went over its data cap. How did the carrier respond?
So the carrier said, if you pay us 2.5 times more, we will, you know, give you full broadband service. We will increase your speeds and you can have whatever speeds you want. And people might say, well, that's the deal that the fire department cut, but that's not really the point. The point is the fire department had no place to go. And what I found really interesting about this whole incident is that neither the Federal Communications Commission nor the Federal Trade Commission, which purportedly is supposed to be protecting consumers in the broadband space now that the FCC has abdicated, said if only the fire department had come to us with a complaint, we could have fixed this. So that's story number one. Story number two, and this is another one where we're really talking about, you know, life and limb being at risk, was it was found by Vice Motherboard, which is a publication, that 3 of the 4 national mobile wireless carriers, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Sprint, were collecting people's precise geolocation data. So in other words, where you are at any particular time on your cell phone, and selling it to data brokers, who then turned around and sold it to bounty hunters for $300 a subscriber. Okay, now bounty hunters find people that don't want to be found, like, for instance, domestic violence victims or estranged girlfriends and boyfriends. So, you know, whether this has resulted in any violence yet, I don't know. But the point is that if there was some FCC oversight, this wouldn't have happened.
Well, okay, people who are in favor of less regulation, they argue that net neutrality was harmful to innovation, stifling competition. Have you seen anything like that?
I don't know how you can stifle competition when most Americans don't have a choice of more than 2 broadband providers. And you said at the, you know, at the change there that internet speeds have gone up. Well, that's nice, but that has nothing to do with net neutrality. That has nothing to do with, you know, whether an ISP has the choice to block you or throttle you or engage in paid prioritization. And the fact that the FCC says that a record high number of Americans have connectivity, the fact of the matter is the FCC has no idea how many Americans have connectivity. They say about 23 million Americans lack connectivity, but other folks, for example, Microsoft has done a test that show that 162 million, so 8 times more, don't have connectivity. The way the FCC collects data on who has broadband is so poor that it doesn't even warrant any mention. So they're very good at promoting themselves and how great the world is. But the fact of the matter is if you have a complaint, if Comcast decides tomorrow to charge you 3 times more than what you pay today, there's nothing you can do about it. No government agency can help you.
Gigi Sohn, let me ask this way. So in the year since net neutrality rules were repealed, have there been any changes that everyday internet users would notice, would appear in front of them and say, wow, that's different?
Yeah, and that is they have nobody to complain to about their internet service. And let me tell you, as a person who worked at the FCC, there were thousands of complaints every month about internet service providers, okay? And number one, that they did engage in net neutrality. Understand that not every violation of the throttling and no blocking and the paid prioritization rule, you know, makes it to the newspaper. You know, sometimes it just happens to people every day and they complain to the FCC about it. So that is, you know, the FCC's complaint system is not something that was, you know, just laid there dormant. We actually had dozens of people answering the phones and going online to collect these complaints. So yeah, that's a big thing that actually affects people every day. Now, did they see major changes in their, you know, in the quality of their internet service to the extent, you know, of blocking, throttling, paid prioritization? No, not yet. But you have to understand something else. This case is under appeal. We are waiting any day now. Is when I get off the phone with you today, I'm going to be waiting to hear news about whether the Federal Court of Appeals here in Washington, D.C. has decided whether the repeal of net neutrality was illegal. So understand that these companies, when it comes to that kind of behavior, are on their best behavior right now.
Can you explain this legal battle over the repeal of net neutrality regulations? Can you explain what each side is arguing?
Sure. Our side, which is a group of nonprofit organizations like the one I used to run, Public Knowledge, and companies like Mozilla and Vimeo and others, and those state attorney generals, said that the FCC did not give an adequate reason for repealing the net neutrality rule. So the FCC's biggest argument, which it makes in return, is that the net neutrality rules stifled broadband investment, and that after the rules were repealed, investment flourished. Well, the fact of the matter is that after the rules were repealed, Verizon, Comcast, Charter, and AT&T all announced that they were going to invest less. This happened almost, you know, like almost right after the FCC repealed the rules, they all announced it. The fact of the matter is regulation rarely impacts investment, and it didn't impact investment there. So that, you know, that emperor had absolutely no clothes. But, you know, there was a 5-hour oral argument. So when you bring a big case like this, you get the opportunity to argue the case in front of a panel of 3 judges. The oral argument went for 5 hours. So it's a very multi-layered argument. But the basic is, we said, what the FCC did in repealing this rule was contrary to law and was not supported by the facts on the record. And I believe that we will win. On what grounds we'll win, I don't know, because there were so many different arguments against this repeal. But I do believe we'll win. And every Tuesday and every Friday, when the D.C. Circuit, which is the Federal Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., puts out decisions, I worry from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. waiting for that decision to come out. And it should come out very soon.
Gigi, why isn't the Federal Trade Commission equipped to handle the job, the rules of governing the Internet and supporting consumers?
God, there's so many reasons. Number one, it doesn't have the technical expertise. It hasn't had a chief technology officer in about a year and a half. I actually testified in an FTC hearing trying to help them be better regulators in this space, and it was amazing how little they knew. That's number one. Number two, the Federal Trade Commission does not have rulemaking authority. So it can't set rules of the road like we did in 2015 that protect consumers before they're harmed. They can only do enforcement after the fact. I mean, look how long it took them to impose a fine on Facebook for the Cambridge Analytica disaster. I mean, it takes forever. They engage in investigation, but they can't protect people before they're harmed. And as I mentioned before, this can actually affect life and limb. Thirdly, and this is really important, the FTC can only go after behavior that is unfair or deceptive. So if you're Internet service provider says, we're not going to block, we're not going to throttle, we're not going to engage in paid prioritization, and they do, that's actionable. But if the Internet service provider tells you it's going to do all those things, then the FTC has nothing to say about it. So to the extent that people are upset about the possibility of underlying behavior, well, that's, the FTC can't do anything about it. So its toolbox for handling these kind of issues is very limited.
In our final moments here, if the net neutrality repeal is upheld, how could it change the Internet as we know it and the way we use the Internet, in the long term?
Well, I think it will give much more control to Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, Charter, or Spectrum, as some people know it. And you'll have a lot less control over it. You will see certain websites, whether you want them to or not, to come up faster. You will see, again, pay-for-play schemes where, you know, companies, kind of like cable TV, right, where, you know, companies pay freight to get on a cable TV system. I just think, you know, what we've so enjoyed about the internet is our ability to control our experience. And I think you will see for sure once the litigation is out of the way. And by the way, this case is likely going to the Supreme Court anyway. I don't know if the Supreme Court will take it, but the litigation is not going to end with this decision from the federal court in D.C. It's going to continue on for a while. But the fact of the matter is you'll have a lot less control over your internet experience.
Gigi, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Gigi Sohn is a distinguished fellow at the Georgetown Law Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy. She served at the Federal Communications Commission from 2013 to 2016 as a counselor to the chairman. Coming up, we look at the history of air conditioning and why the debate over indoor temps is so heated. That's after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the history, the politics, the culture of air conditioning here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. An analyst from J.P. Morgan said this week that air conditioning makers are in a golden era. Demand for new and replacement AC units has been strong since the financial crisis a decade ago. And there are other reasons to be bullish for those analysts as many developing countries start plugging into AC. Do you live without air conditioning either at home or at work? How do you manage? What strategies do you take to stay cool on weeks like this? Do you think the air is too cool at your work or public places? And have you heard or been part of the office temperature debate? We're at 800-642-1234. Penelope Green is a feature writer in the style department of the New York Times. Her recent piece is called "Do Americans Need Air Conditioning?" Penelope, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So you looked over 100 years ago to the beginning of this technology. Why do we have air conditioning?
Well, we have air conditioning because a junior engineer at a printing plant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, figured out a way to blow air over water and reduce the humidity in this printing plant that was gumming up the pages of a humor magazine that was being printed. For millennia, there have been some sort of cooling, mechanical or otherwise, and this really revolutionized it and made it possible to do it more efficiently and put it out there.
And when did we see air conditioning take off? How did it rise in popularity?
Well, they refined the systems and refined the systems. And by the 30s in the White House, there was central air conditioning. And by mid-century in this country, at least, electricity was cheap enough and the technology was good enough that it was in most homes. And, you know, we know it changed manufacturing and it allowed huge areas of the country to be developed. Florida, Houston, the Sun Belt, Singapore, globally, it's called the Air Conditioned Nation. I can give you some fun facts about air conditioning in the White House if you're interested.
Yeah, something about President Nixon?
Well, it was President Nixon loved the air conditioning to be turned down so low that he could turn on the fire, have a fire in the summer. And Lyndon Johnson similarly liked it so low he wanted to sleep with an electric blanket over him in the summer.
You also write that without air conditioning, we'd have no internet because server farms get really hot and they depend on air.
Yes, absolutely. There would be many, many, many industries that would not exist or be possible without air conditioning.
And almost 90% of American homes have air conditioning. Is there any evidence that all this temperature regulation is altering our behaviors or our lifestyles?
Well, I mean, there have been surveys, global surveys done that have shown that those who are in sort of less developed countries have a greater comfort with temperature variability. But I think that, you know, on balance, it's altered our lifestyle for the good. I don't think anybody suggests that we should do away with air conditioning.
Help us understand building efficiency standards. Why do we have them, and how is air conditioning involved?
Well, many states, including New York, have put laws into place that require that will reduce the carbon emissions of the buildings, which are big, big producers, polluters. And in New York State, the benchmark is to reduce carbon emissions by 85% by the year 2050. And air conditioning is a factor. It uses a lot of energy. Interestingly enough, it does not use as much energy across the country as heating does. We use four times more energy to heat our homes and our workplaces than we do to cool them. But the way air conditioning fits into this, again, it's a big energy load, and buildings will be built to these standards that just make them more efficient with better insulation, green roofs, delivering the energy to cool and to heat the spaces with renewables like solar.
When I think of air conditioning, in my youth, I think of the window unit that was hauled down from the attic, put into the window, and then turned on. How have window units impacted efficiency?
Well, not being an HVAC engineer, any engineer of any kind at all, I can tell you that window units get better, but just on balance, they're less efficient from an energy standpoint than central air.
Penelope Green is a feature writer in the style department of the New York Times, and her recent piece is called Do Americans Need Air Conditioning? It's a question that might get a resounding yes, given this week's temperatures. Are you curious about the invention and expansion of air conditioning? Are you concerned we've become too dependent on AC? Do you try to cut back on using it in your own life? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. You can also email your thoughts on AC to ideas@WPR.org. Penelope, in what ways do we overconsume air conditioning? Where do we go overboard?
Well, I think that, again, not being an energy expert, I think that in terms of the experience of people in offices, office workers, many of whom are women, will complain that the AC is just too darn high, and they're freezing in their offices. So I think that that's where the debate comes in, at least in New York City. There's lots of back and forth about the space being engineered or cooled to the thermal comfort of men in suits. And there can be charges every summer that, you know, it's a sexist, gendered temperature. And there's lots of debate on Twitter about that.
Is there merit to that claim that temperatures are adjusted for male employees?
There really isn't. I mean, not in my, you know, very cursory reporting. Our building on 41st Street is cooled to what are known as just an industry standard of 76 degrees. And the building is built with the AC in its floors, and we have ductwork or fans rather at every single desk, and employees are able to sort of open that vent or close that vent in an effort to kind of customize their space. And again, in a sort of anecdotal survey of buildings around the city, most buildings are set to that temperature. The standard by an organization called ASHRAE really asks that building facilities directors alter the temperature of the building or make the temperature of the building something that's comfortable for 80% of the occupants. And that means that 20% of staffers are going to be uncomfortable or miserable.
Yeah.
Too cold or too hot.
And your piece kind of reignited this debate about air conditioning, especially on social media. What was the internet response to your article? What did people say?
Well, my Twitter feed lit up with a lot of women tweeting that they were freezing in their offices, and it lit up with a lot of men being enraged that that anybody suggests that office temperatures were too high or too low. It was quite funny.
Let's go to Owen now in Weawega. Hi, Owen.
Yeah, hello. I had to shut off the radio there, and I think AC makes us lazy. I'm on the farm, and I actually wear long sleeve shirts all summer long. Not so much for UV protection, but just because I actually find that that kind of air conditions me, because I get covered in perspiration, and the cotton shirts kind of keep the moisture around your body so it doesn't evaporate so quickly, and that actually keeps me cooler. But my wife, Lisa, she sleeps in the room with the AC and the window unit, and I sleep in the living room because I find if I sleep in the AC, when I wake up, we get up at 3, we're outside by a little after 3, I even find it's 10 times hotter if I spend the night in that AC room.
Oh, because your body temperature is adjusted to the room that is air-conditioned.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, even when I'm in my truck, I do the same thing. I'll turn the AC on sometimes just to so I can see out the windshield because it has an air dryer. You know, your AC actually dries the air and takes some of the moisture out of the air, which helps when you need to see, but I always roll the windows down at the same time because I don't want to become spoiled and feeling like I'm not climatized to the outside temperature. I grew up with no AC. My father and mother, I'm 40, my father and mother always said that we didn't need AC in Vermont because we only had 3 months out of the year when it wasn't, you know, below 65 degrees anyway. And in the wintertime, we tried so hard to keep it at 62 degrees or you know, in that range. So why would we fight to keep it at a different temperature and spend more money on energy during the summer?
Owen, thank you so much for describing your story. Penelope, you know, Owen's saying, look, air conditioning makes people kind of lazy.
Well, I think that, you know, many would agree with him, and there are studies that have been done, again, that show we, you know, we're so adaptable as humans, and we get used to certain things. That said, I think that nobody would want a manufacturing plant or an assembly line to not be air-conditioned, but certainly in one's home, you can, you know, you can make yourself. You know, I'm a Northeasterner, and you know, we do try and keep our thermostats low in the winter for energy reasons, and you can get used to temperature swings if you really work on it.
Penelope Green is with us. She is a feature writer at the New York Times, and she's been writing about air conditioning. Are you concerned we've become too dependent on it? Are you concerned about the energy use and the climate change impact of all this air conditioning? Do you try to minimize your AC for that reason? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. When the summer heat wave arrives, so does this long-standing debate over the thermostat. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Should the air be cranked up? Should there be throw blankets around the office? The U.S. and China account for over half of the world's air conditioners. According to the International Energy Agency, the number of AC units installed globally is set to jump from about 1.6 billion today to 5.6 billion in about 3 decades from now. Do you live without air conditioning, either at home or work? How do you manage? What strategies do you take to stay cool on weeks like this? Are you concerned our world is becoming too dependent on AC? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. And Penelope Green stays with us. She is a feature writer at the New York Times. Penelope, through your reporting, you interviewed an architecture firm that in 2015 designed its workspace without the convenience of air conditioning. What did you find there?
Oh, this was a wonderful, wonderful experiment. The company is called Kieran Timberlake, and they have 100 employees, and they are you know, a design-forward company trying to sort of figure out how to minimize their impact and the impact of their work from an energy standpoint, and they renovated a former bottling plant, which was made of concrete and steel.
In Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia, and it was built at mid-century, and they decided to do this renovation with the lowest sort of energy impact possible, and they designed the place with passive house technologies, and those are sort of principles. It's a German standard. The idea is to maintain a steady interior climate by making the building envelope pre-airtight and install a system, mostly fans and things like that, to exchange the indoor and the outdoor air. And passive house principles usually mean that you could reduce your energy impact by about 60% to 80%. So they put in mechanical ventilation, that means fans, natural ventilation, that means windows that open, automatic shades to shade the building during the, from the hot sun, it was very, very well insulated, thick concrete slab floor, and dehumidifiers. And the idea is to basically regulate the temperature the way buildings have regulated temperature for thousands of years, like a Roman villa, shading the place against the hot summer sun during the day and then opening up at night to flush out the hot air. And it was complicated. The first summer they opened, the staffers were miserable, and they were surveyed sort of at all points during the day, and basically, and they tried all sorts of things. They tried, working early in the morning when the heat wasn't that great, changing the dress code. People could come to work in shorts.
The employees said they were melting.
They were melting. They really were. And they brought in, fans for the desks and more floor fans. And finally, they just realized that, too many of their staffers were miserable. So they switched to what's known as a mixed mode operation. They brought in conventional air conditioning, but used it sparingly, and that's how the place runs now. And it's a good model for other buildings.
What should we take away from this experience? What did work?
Well, there are two things to take away. One is just the climate in Philadelphia, and maybe that building in particular. Passive house technology without conventional cooling, most passive house building has some kind of cooling in it, but passive house, it works best in places with big diurnal temperature swings like the desert. You could probably do it in the desert where it gets quite cold at night without any conventional cooling at all. But in most places, you do need some air conditioning system. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is they developed a survey technique, a cloud-based app called Roast, and they just, they surveyed their employees constantly, and it helped them refine.
I'm sorry, I'm just laughing at the name of that app. I mean,
I know it's great.
Oh, dear. So they really had to keep an eye on their employees because they don't want their employees to leave them over the temperature. I mean, for goodness sake.
Exactly. And here's another really important thing about that experiment. 41% of Karen Timberlake's employees at the time were female. And so one wondered and one asked, were the respondents who were most miserable men? And in fact, it was not the case that there was a gendered response to the heat. Everybody was pretty miserable. They did learn, however, that more women responded to the survey questions than men.
Let's take another call now. Larry is joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Larry.
Hi there. First of all, I was raised on a farm in central Wisconsin. No air conditioning. You'd work out in the field all day, and you'd sleep at night and sweating. But anyway, every factory that I worked in, except for one, didn't have air conditioning in it. I don't know where she's getting this that factories have air conditioning in it. I worked in a tractor manufacturer. I worked in an outboard manufacturer in different various job shops, and only one of those had air conditioning in it. So I don't know where you're getting this that most factories have air conditioning in them nowadays.
What does the factories you've been in and worked in, Larry, what do they feel like in the summer?
Well, they're hot, but I mean, it's the same thing as in a few degrees warmer than what it is outside, but you struggle through the day. I mean, I guess it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You either want the job or you don't. And, you know, that's just my thought. I mean, like I said, on the farm, nowadays, yes, the tractors have air conditioning, but back in the old days, you wanted to stay cool. You put a fan, umbrella over the seat, and you at least got shaded. I mean, it is what it is. I think, like the other farmer said, we've gotten soft.
Larry, thanks so much for the call. Penelope, I mean, if you want the work in the factory, you go to the work, regardless of the temperature.
It is the case that fans which electric fans came into play in a widespread way at the same time that our friend in Williamsburg invented what would become the conventional air conditioner. Fans have altered manufacturing as well, and it also may be the case that there are regional differences that companies and industries further south may have to deploy air conditioning. And in places like yours, where the temperatures aren't quite so brutal, it might be possible to live without it.
Well, let's fit in one more call here. Justin in Madison. Hi, Justin. Justin is not there. Penelope, climate change is only going to make our world warmer. What can we expect for the future of air conditioning?
I just think that it will get more efficient and buildings will get more efficient. Certainly in this country, many, many states have enacted similar laws to the ones that we have here in New York City and in New York State to curtail the carbon emissions of new buildings and retrofit older ones, commercial spaces, that is. So I think there's a lot of hope in ingenuity.
Although at the same time, around the world, countries are, basically plugging into air conditioning, China being the other biggest user of air conditioners. How do we see other places around the world changing their perspective on air conditioning?
Well, I think that as countries grow richer and they can afford it, they're going to clamor for it. You noted some statistics about that. We can only hope that climate change agreements like the Paris Accord will be taken up by developing nations and they'll do the right thing.
Penelope, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Penelope Green is a feature writer in the style department of the New York Times. Her recent piece is called Do Americans Need Air Conditioning? And we have a link to it on the Morning Show page at WPR.org. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.